Welcome to the Women and Wealth Podcast with Esther Szabo. Esther is a respected leader in the field of personal financial advice with over 25 years of experience. After going through her own significant and challenging life-changing events, she overcame fear and self-doubt to launch her own successful advisory firm. Now Esther is ready to share her practical and personal experiences to help other women clear their hurdles and brave life's transitions. In this way, she inspires women to lead fulfilling and confident lives.
Hello and welcome to Women and Wealth with Esther Szabo from Gates Pass Advisors. Today I'm excited we have a special podcast. Esther brought in a guest, and that is Kirk Dryden. Kirk has been in the insurance industry for over 40 years. In 1996, Mr. Dryden founded his own firm, focusing on wealth preservation strategies, business succession planning, and executive benefit programs. He is a licensed life analyst and has served as an expert witness in insurance matters. In addition to his university degrees, Mr. Dryden has earned his CLU, which is Chartered Life Underwriter, and CHFC, Chartered Financial Consultant designations. Good morning, Esther and Kirk. How are you?
Good morning, Eric. Good morning. I will speak for myself. I'm doing great.
And I'm doing well as well.
Fantastic. Kirk, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You bet. Hey, Esther, how did you meet Kirk?
Well, Kirk and I have known each other for a long time. I would say probably about 15 years at this point. Mm-hmm. We met in the Peninsula Estate Planning Council, which is a group of professionals who in banking, in insurance, in financial, and we would meet regularly once a month. And it was my pleasure to meet and get to know Kirk there.
Now, Kirk sounds like a great guy, and I don't mean anything by this, but why did you bring him in today?
Well, I have known Kirk for about 15 years. And with Kirk, what I really appreciate is he works as a very professional consultant on these insurance matters. He may not be aware, but insurance agents can have a very bad reputation for selling things mm-hmm. to people that they don't need, selling it on fear and better have this or else. And Kirk is not that way at all. He is very much respectful of the work that we do with client planning in terms of determining what risks are there. And we bring Kirk in as a consultant to say, how can we address these gaps that are putting you at risk? And he's very educational minded. He is very respectful of the clients because he does gather very personal information, their medical information. And he is very much step by step on guiding the clients through the process. So I really appreciate his approach, his knowledge, and how he engages with us as planners on behalf of the client.
That's fantastic. Kirk, I got to be honest with you. I don't know a lot about long-term care. I know that that's the subject of this podcast. And I'm just curious, can you give us a bit of a history of long-term care, kind of when it started, when it was founded, and what it means?
Be happy to. But first, let me thank Esther for the kind introduction. If you step back and look at long-term care and where it came from, I think it's helpful in helping you understand how it evolved to where we are today. And in the 60s, there seemed to be a number of situations where people were in the hospital for treatment but had recovered to the point where they did not need to be hospitalized but need to be in some kind of a care facility. And that care facility was usually a nursing home. And those nursing home expenses at that time were mostly not covered by medical insurance. There was no long-term care to speak of. It was still in its infancy. But these large nursing home expenses, uncovered nursing home expenses, would result many times in the forced sale of a house to cover the cost. Mm. And so there was a general desire on the part of planners and certainly patients to find a way to pay for long-term care expenses. And that grew into a nursing home kind of policy. And this is in the late 60s, early 70s. So there was a way for people that were discharged from the hospital but still needed care to go into a nursing home environment. And so the initial long-term care policies were nursing home only. That is still a lot of people's understanding of what long-term care is. as medical technology advanced in the 1970s, people were able to receive treatment in a less structured environment. In other words, perhaps a house, a home care type situation, or assisted living. So the long-term care nursing home policies evolved, and eventually people were able to receive this treatment in a home care environment. And so we kind of have the evolution of what we see today as the modern long-term care policy. In the 1980s, these policies were marketed heavily, and they included the nursing home, assisted living coverage, and home health care. Many new companies entered the market. It was a very lucrative, viewed as a very lucrative source of business for them. In the 1990s, growth in long-term care exploded. Many new companies were in the market. New policy writers were introduced, and plan designs allowed for much more customization of policies than existed in the past. In the 1990s and 2000, the number of companies offering long-term care continued to grow. Many of those policies were marketed with very rich benefit riders and surprisingly low premiums. The long-term care insurers came to realization that they were offering this product at a loss, and that some of the assumptions that they initially made in the design of the product were causing the problem. So some of them left the market entirely, and others repriced product.
So I'm going to jump in here, because this is the part where I think primarily long-term care gets such a bad reputation. So many negative articles have been written about exactly this, these rate increases. That's so much of what is in the media about long-term care. And it is a conversation I have with many clients. The ones who most are likely to go ahead and get the long-term care coverage are ones who have experienced within the family and have seen how expensive it is. Mm-hmm. But others just say, no, the things that come back are, I've heard it's very expensive. I've heard that it can jump in premium so much. And even so, I found it a very, very emotional decision for people. I mean, I know I got my coverage when I was in my late 40s, and for a number of reasons, but primarily because I don't have family to take care of me I don't have children. And these are really critical things that I wanted to spend time on today, just to say, what does it look like from the other side? We know that the prices can go up, but if Kirk, you could put some more context behind this.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the early long-term care policies. We'll call them legacy policies. From the inception, insurers were responding to market demand and coming out with a product that would meet some of these heretofore uncovered costs. If you step back and look at the insurance industry, I mean, you've got life insurance, you've got disability, auto insurance, home insurance, health insurance. They're all mature product lines, and they've got statistics to support the pricing model. Not so with long-term care. And so the insurers made some assumptions, and they were off fairly dramatically in those assumptions. One of the things that is logical when you stop and think about it is that the growth in medical technology has enabled people to continue living, and in some cases living a pretty active lifestyle that they wouldn't have been able to do before, and that has increased medical costs. So those get passed on to the long-term care carriers. The insurance companies, when they were designing product, also misanalyzed the lapse rate, the number of people that would buy the policy and keep it. They assumed that quite a few would actually terminate coverage. Just the opposite occurred. People kept the policies until they were on claim. And all of a sudden, the insurance companies were forced to pay out claims that they didn't foresee or didn't price for. That, of course, increased their assumptions in terms of number of people actually receiving benefits and the duration of claims. Most of the actuaries at that time felt that the long-term care benefits would not be paid for more than several years. Well, it turns out that some of them were on the hook, so to speak, for a much longer period of time. The product offerings included things like a 5% compound cost of living. That means that for every year that somebody has the product, the benefit goes up by 5% compound. And if you look at interest rates in the early 2000s, they weren't much higher than that. And then they decreased. So all of a sudden, you've got insurance companies with this book of business that obligates them to increase the benefit at 5% compound. And many times their portfolio rate wasn't matching that. So that had a very significant impact on increasing the cost to the insurance companies. Mm-hmm. The other thing that they do, and insurance companies are sometimes want to increase market share. And so they come out with increased benefits without sometimes projecting exactly what the cost will be. And one of those is a lifetime benefit rider. If you have a policy that is committed to paying lifetime benefits and the benefits are compounded by 5% per year, whether somebody is on claim or not, that's an awful large potential obligation that they have to assume. And they didn't price correctly for it.
So I'm going to jump in if I could. So that those things are so critical. And I would imagine that most normal human beings, perhaps you may have glazed over a little bit because that's a lot of information, but it's so critical. I want to go back to it because this is exactly what went wrong, not in terms of the need for long-term care coverage, but what went wrong in terms of how the insurance companies put together their packages and priced them. And I always make the comparison with why ongoing financial planning is critical. We do something similar. We put together assumptions for what will happen in the market, what will happen in terms of clients' income, what their expenses will be. But we connect with the clients very regularly on that. When with the insurance companies, they put together assumptions for how medical costs would increase, how those expenses would increase, how many clients they would have to cover. They were too low on the medical costs. They were too high on how many people they thought would drop the insurance. Mm-hmm. So they had more people to cover than they expected. They were too low on how many claims would come in and how long that they would be in place, and too positive about how the pool of money that they get from the premiums that are paid, how much money that would make for them. Because we hit that buzzsaw of the recession in 2008 where interest rates dropped like a rock. And as Kirk said, they were committed to paying out 5% more per year each year at a time when interest rates were basically zero. So it was kind of like a perfect storm situation of what went wrong with the assumptions and not checking and rechecking and confirming.
And I would assume that the other thing is, like Kirk said, with the increase in medical advancement, people were living longer. So they probably kind of thought more people would die off sooner, not to be morbid, but die off sooner than they thought. And so more people were surviving longer, so they had to pay out benefits for a much longer time than anticipated.
That's exactly right. Going back to the product design for a minute, one of the things that, let me just relate a personal story. I have a business owner, and at the time, about 15 years ago when he purchased the policy, he bought a benefit that was $300 a month, or $300 a day, excuse me, benefit. 5% compound cost of living rider, lifetime benefits, and a 10-pay product, meaning after 10 years, he no longer has to pay any premiums.
Ooh,
so
wow.
He thinks he's got something that is cast in gold, and he's right because he couldn't buy the same thing that he's got today. But my gosh, the insurance company has obligated themselves to what is potentially a very, very large claim. And you can't price for that. And I think as a result of the claim experience that they began to be having, or began to have, excuse me, a lot of these benefits were pulled back. The insurance company would make minor benefit changes in the product and file a new policy with the state insurance department. And that filing would generally remove some of the richer elements that the product originally contained, like the 5% cost of living benefit rider. Those aren't available anymore. The highest rider we see today is a 3% compound cost of living. Lifetime benefits aren't available any longer. Those kinds of things. And so they got to modify the benefits on the policies being sold from that point forward, but they were still locked into a block of business that had these very rich benefits. Mm-hmm. And so they would apply to the various state insurance departments for rate increase. And those rate increases have been granted fairly easily in some states and with great difficulty in others. California has been traditionally one of the states that has been very loath to give rate increases to existing policyholders, but we have seen some come through. We've also seen some very interesting approaches to things. I have a client, a group of executives that had 5% compound cost of living benefits. Well, rather than change the underlying policy, what they did was increase the cost if people wanted to continue with the 5% compound by 60%. And whoa. So the option given to these people was, if you take a lower cost of living factor, in this case from 5% to 2.75, they would keep the premium where it was originally at when the policies were taken out about 10 years ago. So needless to say, everybody has taken that that offering. These product revisions are almost universal. They still don't cover the costs in the existing legacy block of business, the original policies. So insurance companies have rate modification applications sitting on each state insurance department desk, and they are generally very slow in doing that. But we do see some increases. When that does happen, people are usually given an option of adjusting the benefits. And one of the first things we recommend they look at are things like 5% compound or a very drawn out benefit period, and try and reduce that. Going back to the example I just used with this group of 10 people, they have had this compound benefit for about 12 years now. So that has grown to a fairly significant benefit in that period of time. So even though we've adjusted any future increases from 5 to 2.75, they're building on a pretty good base at this point in time. So it's not as terrible as it sounds, but you really have to look at it and analyze each situation separately.
Hey, Kirk, can I ask a quick question about this?
Yeah.
Okay, just to kind of clarify, and maybe you have a different view of this, but to me as a layman, I'm looking at this thinking, it sounds a lot like I go buy a brand new car and the company says, okay, we're going to give you a warranty that covers everything bumper to bumper for the rest of your life. And I pay a certain amount for that warranty every month, but then they find out they're losing money. So 5-10 years down the road, they say, you know what, we need to make some alterations. You can still keep this warranty. However, we need to remove two of the gears and the radio, because we see a high cost of those items in our, you know, in getting claimed in warranties. And then a couple of years later, they want to take away one of the wheels, right? Because they see a problem with that. It doesn't seem fair to me, right? Because I bought this car in good faith that everything would stay the same and I'd still have the benefits of that exact same car in 10 or 20 years. Is that a good analogy or not?
I think it's one that a lot of people probably hold. The best way I would respond to that would be that setting prices for insurance products is an imperfect science, and they are evolving as they get more claims data. And I'll talk about that a little more in the future here. And that, I think, is going to stabilize the rate increases that we've been seeing on new products.
Gotcha. Okay.
So, Kirk, I appreciate what you have just gone over. I'm wondering, one of the things that we've talked about a bit today is that people might be thinking, oh, goodness, you know, I have an older policy. And should I be worried about the company that I'm insured by potentially maybe going out of business? What does happen in those cases? Because there have been long-term care companies that have gone out of business. What happens with the policies then?
I think you raise a good point, Esther. You shouldn't buy a product and just put it on the shelf and not review it periodically, particularly with a product that's undergoing change as is happening in the long-term care marketplace. Some companies have exited the business. The industry as a whole has been pretty good at picking up books of business for companies that were trying to sell them. Many companies have stopped marketing any new policies, but they still service the block of business that they have. So at this point in time, I'm not aware of anybody that has really suffered significant financial loss from their company going out of business, because usually those books of business are purchased. The one that we're all waiting to see evolve is the largest writer of long-term care named Genworth. And as we speak, Genworth has been in negotiations with China Oceanside, which is a holding company in China, that is looking to acquire their long-term business and transfer their policy owner expertise in the long-term care area to China, where they've got a rapidly aging population. And their traditional family mix is changing, where the children may not take care of the in-laws, that sort of thing. Just this morning, I saw a news release that the New York State Insurance Department approved. They were one of the last people to approve the acquisition, and they have approved that. So it's moving forward. It's not completely done, but it certainly is looking positive at this point in time. And I think that will result in an element of stability to the marketplace, because it represents a very large book of business.
Thank you, Kirk. I really appreciate that what we've talked about here today, which is a lot of the context and the history behind the long-term care insurance area. And what we'll be doing is closing this up for today, but on our next podcast, we'll be talking more about, well, how do I put this into my financial picture? What is a way to design an insurance program for me? And I'll be talking about some client examples, and then you will also be sharing about the different ways one can put a program together for this very critical need as we age. But before we close today, I'm wondering, if somebody is listening to this and they do have one of those older policies, or they're considering whether or not this is something they should look at, are you available to review policies?
I'd be happy to do so.
How do you go about doing that?
Depending on the situation and where the person's located, we may do that by email, over the phone, get copies of their policies and review them. We can also set a time and get together.
And I know we've done that a lot in our practice here. And Kirk, how do people reach you?
My email address is kdryden@johnsondugan.com, kdryden@johnsondugan.com, or 650-238-3214.
Thank you, Kirk. I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Esther.
Great. This is great. Brought up a lot of questions for me, so I'm really excited about that next podcast, and I hope you're ready to answer a lot of those questions, Kirk.
I will be by the time we talk again.
All right. You got a couple of weeks to prep. Get busy, because we're gonna fire those questions at you.
Okay. Nice meeting you, Eric.
Nice meeting you, Kirk. Look forward to talking again. And thank you all for listening to the Women in Wealth podcast with Esther Szabo. If you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, please click the subscribe now button below. This way, when Esther comes out with a new podcast, it'll show up directly on your listening device. This makes it much easier to share these podcasts with your friends and family. And if you have family that's a little older that you think may have a policy or may need one, please share this with them. They need to hear these things. They need to hear what's happened in the industry. And Kirk is the expert. And again, he's agreed to come back. So Get them prepped for the next one. Again, thanks for listening today. For everyone at Gates Pass Advisors, this is Eric Johnson reminding you to live your best day every day. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Women and Wealth Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you receive notifications of new podcasts as they become available. Check out the website at www.gatespassadvisors.com for more information. This content is developed from sources believed to be providing accurate information. The information in this material is not intended as tax or legal advice. Please consult legal or tax professionals for specific information regarding your individual situation. The opinions expressed and material provided are for general information and should not be considered a solicitation for the purchase or sale of any security.